This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. This book is read by Tom Taylorson. To my grandmother, Lula Brisbane Moody, who taught me the power of truth, love, and imagination. And to my grandson, Grant Ethan Miller, who inspires me to do whatever it takes to create a world he and his brothers and sisters across the planet will want to inherit. Preface. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. I wrote that in 1982, as the beginning of a book with the working title, Conscience of an Economic Hitman. The book was dedicated to the heads of state of two countries, men who had been my clients, whom I respected and thought of as kindred spirits. Jaime Roldós of Ecuador and Omar Torrijos of Panama. Both had just died in fiery crashes. Their deaths were not accidental. They were assassinated because they opposed that fraternity of corporate, government, and banking heads whose goal is global empire. We EHMs failed to bring Roldós and Torrijos around, and the other type of hitmen, the CIA-sanctioned jackals who were always right behind us, stepped in. I was persuaded to stop writing that book. I started it four more times during the next 20 years. On each occasion, my decision to begin again was influenced by current world events. The U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989, the first Gulf War, Somalia, the rise of Osama bin Laden. However, threats or bribes always convinced me to stop. In 2003, the president of a major publishing house that is owned by a powerful international corporation read a draft of what had now become Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He described it as a riveting story that needs to be told. Then he smiled sadly, shook his head, and told me that since the executives at World Headquarters might object, he could not afford to risk publishing it. He advised me to fictionalize it. We could market you in the mold of a novelist like John le Carré or Graham Greene. But this is not fiction. It is the true story of my life. It is the story of the creation of a system that has failed us. A more courageous publisher, one not owned by an international corporation, agreed to help me tell it. What finally convinced me to ignore the threats and bribes? The short answer is that my only child, Jessica, graduated from college and went out into the world on her own. When I told her that I was considering publishing this book and shared my fears with her, she said, "Don't worry, Dad. If they get you, I'll take over where you left off. We need to do this for the grandchildren I hope to give you someday." That is the short answer. The longer version relates to my dedication to the country where I was raised, to my love of the ideals expressed by our founding fathers, to my deep commitment to the American Republic that today promises life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people everywhere, and to my determination after 9/11 not to sit idly by any longer while EHMs turn that republic into a global empire. That is the skeleton version of the long answer. The flesh and blood are added in the chapters that follow. Why was I not killed for telling this story? As I will explain in more detail in the pages of The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, the book itself became my insurance policy. This is a true story. I lived every minute of it. The sights, the people, the conversations, and the feelings I describe were all a part of my life. It is my personal story, and yet it happened within the larger context of world events that have shaped our history, have brought us to where we are today, and form the foundation of our children's futures. I have made every effort to present these experiences, people, and conversations accurately. Whenever I discuss historical events or recreate conversations with other people, I do so with the help of several tools. Published documents, personal records and notes, recollections, my own and those of others who participated, the 5 manuscripts I began previously, and historical accounts by other authors, most notably recently published ones that disclose information that formerly was classified or otherwise unavailable. References are provided in the endnotes to allow interested readers to pursue these subjects in more depth. In some cases, I combine several dialogues I had with a person into one conversation to facilitate the flow of the narrative. My publisher asked whether we actually referred to ourselves as economic hitmen. I assured him that we did, although usually only by the initials. In fact, on the day in 1971 when I began working with my teacher, Claudine, she informed me, "My assignment is to mold you into an economic hitman. No one can know about your involvement. Not even your wife." Then she turned serious. "Once you're in for life." Claudine pulled no punches when describing what I would be called upon to do. My job, she said, was to encourage world leaders to become part of a vast network that promotes U.S. commercial interests. In the end, those leaders become ensnared in a web of debt that ensures their loyalty. We can draw on them whenever we desire, to satisfy our political, economic, or military needs. In turn, they bolster their political positions by bringing industrial parks, power plants, and airports to their people. The owners of U.S. engineering/construction companies become fabulously wealthy. If we faltered, a more malicious form of hitman, the jackal, would step to the plate. And if the jackals failed, then the job fell to the military. Now, nearly 12 years after Confessions of an Economic Hitman was first published, that original publisher and I know that it is time for a new edition. Readers of the 2004 book sent thousands of emails asking how its publication impacted my life, what I am doing to redeem myself and change the EHM system, and what actions they can take to turn things around. This new book is my answer to those questions. It is also time for a new edition because the world has changed radically. The EHM system, based primarily on debt and fear, is even more treacherous now than it was in 2004. The EHMs have radically expanded their ranks and have adopted new disguises and tools. And we in the United States have been hit badly. The entire world has been hit. We know that we teeter on the edge of disaster. Economic, political, social, and environmental disaster. We must change. This story must be told. We live in a time of terrible crisis and tremendous opportunity. The story of this particular economic hitman is the story of how we got to where we are and why we currently face crises that often seem insurmountable. This book is the confession of a man who, back when I was an EHM, was part of a relatively small group. People who play similar roles are much more abundant now. They have euphemistic titles. They walk the corridors of Fortune 500 companies like Exxon, Walmart, General Motors, and Monsanto. They use the EHM system to promote their private interests. In a very real sense, the New Confessions of an Economic Hitman is the story of this new EHM breed. It is your story, too. The story of your world and mine. We are all complicit. We must take responsibility for our world. The EHMs succeed because we collaborate with them. They seduce, cajole, and threaten us. But they win only when we look the other way or simply give in to their tactics. By the time you hear these words, events will have happened that I cannot imagine as I write them. Please see this book as offering new perspectives for understanding those events and future ones. Admitting to a problem is the first step toward finding a solution. Confessing a sin is the beginning of redemption. Let this book, then, be the start of our salvation. Let it inspire us to new levels of dedication and drive us to realize our dream of balanced and honorable societies. John Perkins, October 2015. Introduction. The New Confessions. I'm haunted every day by what I did as an economic hitman, EHM. I'm haunted by the lies I told back then about the World Bank. I'm haunted by the ways in which that bank, its sister organizations, and I empowered U.S. corporations to spread their cancerous tentacles across the planet. I'm haunted by the payoffs to the leaders of poor countries, the blackmail, and the threats that if they resisted, if they refused to accept loans that would enslave their countries in debt, the CIA's jackals would overthrow or assassinate them. I wake up sometimes to the horrifying images of heads of state, friends of mine, who died violent deaths because they refused to betray their people. Like Shakespeare's Lady Macbeth, I try to scrub the blood from my hands. But the blood is merely a symptom. The treacherous cancer beneath the surface, which was revealed in the original confessions of an economic hitman, has metastasized. It has spread from the economically developing countries to the United States and the rest of the world. It attacks the very foundations of democracy and the planet's life support systems. All the EHM tools and jackal tools, false economics, false promises, threats, bribes, extortion, debt, deception, coups, assassinations, unbridled military power, are used around the world today, even more than during the era I exposed more than a decade ago. Although this cancer has spread widely and deeply, most people still aren't aware of it. Yet all of us are impacted by the collapse it has caused. It has become the dominant system of economics, government, and society today. Fear and debt drive this system. We are hammered with messages that terrify us into believing that we must pay any price, assume any debt, to stop the enemies who, we are told, lurk at our doorsteps. The problem comes from somewhere else. Insurgents, terrorists, them. And its solution requires spending massive amounts of money on goods and services produced by what I call the corporatocracy. Vast networks of corporations, banks, colluding governments, and the rich and powerful people tied to them. We go deeply into debt. Our country and its financial henchmen at the World Bank and its sister institutions coerce other countries to go deeply into debt. Debt enslaves us, and it enslaves those countries. These strategies have created a death economy, one based on wars or the threat of war, debt, and the rape of the Earth's resources. It is an unsustainable economy that depletes at ever-increasing rates the very resources upon which it depends, and at the same time poisons the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the foods we eat. Although the death economy is built on a form of capitalism, it is important to note that the word capitalism refers to an economic and political system in which trade and industry are controlled by private owners rather than the state. It includes local farmers' markets as well as this very dangerous form of global corporate capitalism, controlled by the corporatocracy, which is predatory by nature, has created a death economy, and ultimately is self-destructive. I decided to write The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman because things have changed so much during this past decade. The cancer has spread throughout the United States, as well as the rest of the world. The rich have gotten richer, and everyone else has gotten poorer, in real terms. A powerful propaganda machine owned or controlled by the corporatocracy has spun its stories to convince us to accept a dogma that serves its interests, not ours. These stories contrive to convince us that we must embrace a system based on fear and debt, accumulating stuff, and dividing and conquering everyone who isn't us. The stories have sold us the lie that the EHM system will provide security and make us happy. Some would blame our current problems on an organized global conspiracy. I wish it were so simple. Although, as I point out later, there are hundreds of conspiracies, not just one grand conspiracy, that affect all of us. The EHM system is fueled by something far more dangerous than a global conspiracy. It is driven by concepts that have become accepted as gospel, We believe that all economic growth benefits humankind, and that the greater the growth, the more widespread the benefits. Similarly, we believe that those people who excel at stoking the fires of this economic growth should be exalted and rewarded, while those born at the fringes are available for exploitation. And we believe that any means, including those used by today's EHMs and jackals, are justified to promote economic growth, preserve our comfortable, affluent Western way of life, and wage war against anyone, such as Islamic terrorists, who might threaten our economic well-being, comfort, and security. In response to readers' requests, I have added many new details and accounts of how we did our work during my time as an EHM, and I've clarified some points in the previously published chapters. More importantly, I have added an entirely new Part 5, which explains how the EHM game is played today. Who today's economic hitmen are, who today's jackals are, and how their deceptions and tools are more far-reaching and enslaving now than ever. Also in response to readers' requests, Part 5 includes new chapters that reveal what it will take to overthrow the EHM system and specific tactics for doing so. The book ends with a section titled Documentation of EHM Activity, 2004 to 2015, which complements my personal story by offering detailed information for readers who want further proof of the issues covered in this book, or who want to pursue these subjects in more depth. Despite all the bad news and the attempts of modern-day robber barons to steal our democracy and our planet, I am filled with hope. I know that when enough of us perceive the true workings of this EHM system, we will take the individual and collective actions necessary to control the cancer and restore our health. The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman reveals how the system works today and what you and I, all of us, can do to change it. Tom Paine inspired American revolutionaries when he wrote, "If there must be trouble, let it be in my day, that my child may have peace." These words are as important today as they were in 1776. My goal in this new book is nothing less than Paine's, to inspire and empower us all to do whatever it takes to lead the way to peace for our children. Part 1, 1963 to 1971. Chapter 1, Dirty Business. When I graduated from business school in 1968, I was determined not to participate in the Vietnam War. I had recently married Anne. She, too, opposed the war and was adventurous enough to agree to join the Peace Corps with me. We first arrived in Quito, Ecuador in 1968. I was a 23-year-old volunteer assigned to develop credit and savings cooperatives in communities deep in the Amazon rainforest. Anne's job was to teach hygiene and childcare to indigenous women. Anne had been to Europe, but it was my first trip away from North America. I knew we'd fly into Quito, one of the highest capitals in the world, and one of the poorest. I expected it to be different from anything I'd ever seen, but I was totally unprepared for the reality. As our plane from Miami descended toward the airport, I was shocked by the hovels along the runway. I leaned across Anne in the middle seat and, pointing through my window, asked the Ecuadorian businessman in the aisle seat next to her, "Do people actually live there?" "We are a poor country," he replied, nodding solemnly. The scenes that greeted us on the bus ride into town were even worse. Tattered beggars hobbling on homemade crutches along garbage-infested streets, children with horribly distended bellies, skeletal dogs, and shanty towns of cardboard boxes that passed as homes. The bus delivered us to Quito's five-star hotel, the Intercontinental. It was an island of luxury in that sea of poverty, and the place where I and about 30 other Peace Corps volunteers would attend several days of in-country briefings. During the first of many lectures, we were informed that Ecuador was a combination of feudal Europe and the American Wild West. Our teachers prepped us about all the dangers: venomous snakes, malaria, anacondas, killer parasites, and hostile headhunting warriors. Then the good news. Texaco had discovered vast oil deposits, not far from where we'd be stationed in the rainforest. We were assured that oil would transform Ecuador from one of the poorest countries in the hemisphere to one of the richest. One afternoon, while waiting for a hotel elevator, I struck up a conversation with a tall blonde man who had a Texas drawl. He was a seismologist, a Texaco consultant. When he learned that Ann and I were poor Peace Corps volunteers who'd be working in the rainforest, he invited us to dinner in the elegant restaurant on the top floor of the hotel. I couldn't believe my good fortune. I'd seen the menu and knew that our meal would cost more than our monthly living allowance. That night, as I looked through the restaurant's windows out at Pichincha, the mammoth volcano that hovers over Ecuador's capital, and sipped a margarita, I became infatuated with this man and the life he lived. He told us that sometimes he flew in a corporate jet directly from Houston to an airstrip hacked out of the jungle. "We don't have to endure immigration or customs," he bragged. "The Ecuadorian government gives us special permission." His rainforest experience included air-conditioned trailers and champagne, and filet mignon dinners served on fine china. "Not what you'll be getting, I assume," he said with a laugh. He then talked about the report he was writing that described a vast sea of oil beneath the jungle. This report, he said, would be used to justify huge world bank loans to the country and to persuade Wall Street to invest in Texaco and other businesses that would benefit from the oil boom. When I expressed amazement that progress could happen so rapidly, he gave me an odd look. "What did they teach you in business school anyway?" he asked. I didn't know how to respond. "Look," he said, "it's an old game. I've seen it in Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. Now here. Seismology reports, combined with one good oil well, a gusher like the one we just hit." He smiled. "Boomtown." Ann mentioned all the excitement around how oil would bring prosperity to Ecuadorians. "Only those smart enough to play the game," he said. I'd grown up in a New Hampshire town named after a man who'd built a mansion on a hill, overlooking everyone else, using the fortune he'd amassed by selling shovels and blankets to the California gold miners in 1849. "The merchants," I said. "The businessmen and bankers." "You bet. And today, the big corporations." He tilted back in his chair. "We own this country. We get a lot more than permission to land planes without customs formalities." "Like what?" "Oh my God, you do have a lot to learn, don't you?" He raised his martini toward the city. "To begin with, we control the military. We pay their salaries and buy them their equipment. They protect us from the Indians who don't want oil rigs on their lands. In Latin America, he who controls the army controls the president and the courts. We get to write the laws, set fines for oil spills, labor rates, all the laws that matter to us."
"Texaco pays for all that?" Ann asked.
"Well, not exactly." He reached across the table and patted her arm. "You do. Or your daddy does. The American taxpayer. The money flows through USAID, the World Bank, CIA, and the Pentagon, but everyone here," he swept his arm toward the window and the city below, "knows it's all about Texaco. Remember, countries like this have long histories of coups. If you take a good look, you'll see that most of them happen when the leaders of the country don't play our game."
"Are you saying Texaco overthrows governments?" I asked.
He laughed. "Let's just say that governments that don't cooperate are seen as Soviet puppets. They threaten American interests and democracy. The CIA doesn't like that." That night was the beginning of my education in what I've come to think of as the EHM system. Ann and I spent the next month stationed in the Amazon rainforest. Then we were transferred to the high Andes, where I was assigned to help a group of campesino brickmakers. Ann trained handicapped people for jobs in local businesses. I was told that the brickmakers needed to improve the efficiency of the archaic ovens in which their bricks were baked. However, one after another they came to me complaining about the men who owned the trucks and the warehouses down in the city. Ecuador was a country with little social mobility. A few wealthy families, the ricos, ran just about everything, including local businesses and politics. Their agents bought the bricks from the brickmakers at extremely low prices and sold them at roughly 10 times that amount. One brickmaker went to the city mayor and complained. Several days later, He was struck by a truck and killed. Terror swept the community. People assured me that he'd been murdered. My suspicions that it was true were reinforced when the police chief announced that the dead man was part of a Cuban plot to turn Ecuador communist. Che Guevara had been executed by a CIA operation in Bolivia less than 3 years earlier. He insinuated that any brickmaker who caused trouble would be arrested as an insurgent. The brickmakers begged me to go to the Ricos and set things right. They were willing to do anything to appease those they feared, including convincing themselves that if they gave in, the Ricos would protect them. I didn't know what to do. I had no leverage with the mayor, and figured that the intervention of a 25-year-old foreigner would only make matters worse. I merely listened and sympathized. Eventually, I realized that the Ricos were part of a strategy, a system that had subjugated Andean peoples through fear since the Spanish conquest. I saw that by commiserating, I was enabling the community to do nothing. They needed to learn to face their fears. They needed to admit to the anger they had suppressed. They needed to take offense at the injustices they had suffered. They needed to stop looking to me to set things right. They needed to stand up to the Ricos. Late one afternoon, I spoke to the community. I told them that they had to take action. They had to do whatever it would take, including taking the risk of being killed, so that their children could prosper and live in peace. My realization about enabling that community was a great lesson for me. I understood that the people themselves were collaborators in this conspiracy, and that convincing them to take action offered the only solution. And it worked. The brickmakers formed a co-op. Each family donated bricks, and the co-op used the income from those bricks to rent a truck and warehouse in the city. The Ricos boycotted the co-op, until a Lutheran mission from Norway contracted with the co-op for all the bricks for a school it was building, at about 5 times the amount the Ricos had paid the brickmakers, but half the price the Ricos were charging the Lutherans. A win-win situation for everyone, except the Ricos. The co-op flourished after that. Less than a year later, Anne and I completed our Peace Corps assignment. I was 26 and no longer subject to the draft. I became an EHM. When I first entered those ranks, I convinced myself that I was doing the right thing. South Vietnam had fallen to the communist North, and now the world was threatened by the Soviet Union and China. My business school professors had taught that financing infrastructure projects through mountains of World Bank debt would pull economically developing nations out of poverty and save them from the clutches of communism. Experts at the World Bank and USAID reinforced this mindset. By the time I discovered the falsehoods in that story, I felt trapped by the system. I had grown up feeling poor in my New Hampshire boarding school, but suddenly I was making a great deal of money, traveling first class to countries I'd dreamed about all my life, staying in the best hotels, eating in the finest restaurants, and meeting with heads of state. I had made it. How could I even consider getting out? Then the nightmares began. I woke in dark hotel rooms, sweating, haunted by images of sights I had actually seen. Legless lepers strapped into wooden boxes on wheels, rolling along the streets of Jakarta. Men and women bathing in slime-green canals, while next to them, others defecated. A human cadaver abandoned on a garbage heap, swarming with maggots and flies. And children who slept in cardboard boxes, vying with roaming packs of dogs for scraps of rubbish. I realized that I'd distanced myself emotionally from these things. Like other Americans, I'd seen these people as less than human. They were beggars, misfits. Them. One day my Indonesian government limo stopped at a traffic light. A leper thrust the gory remnants of a hand through my window. My driver yelled at him. The leper grinned, a lopsided, toothless smile, and withdrew. We drove on, but his spirit remained with me. It was as though he had sought me out. His bloody stump was a warning, his smile a message. Reform, he seemed to say. Repent. I began to look more closely at the world around me. and at myself. I came to understand that although I had all the trappings of success, I was miserable. I'd been popping Valium every night and drinking lots of alcohol. I'd get up in the morning, force coffee and pep pills into my system, and stagger off to negotiate contracts worth hundreds of millions of dollars. That life had come to seem normal to me. I had bought into the stories. I was taking on debt to support my lifestyle. I was operating out of fear. The fear of communism, losing my job, failure, and not having the material things everyone told me I needed. One night I woke up with the memory of a different type of dream. I'd walked into the office of a leader in a country that had just discovered it had lots of oil. "Our construction companies," I told him, "will rent equipment from your brother's John Deere franchise. We'll pay twice the going rate. Your brother can share his profits with you." In the dream, I went on to explain that we'd make similar deals with friends of his who owned Coca-Cola bottling plants, other food and beverage suppliers, and labor contractors. All he had to do was sign off on a World Bank loan that would hire U.S. corporations to build infrastructure projects in his country. Then I casually mentioned that a refusal would bring in the jackals. "Remember," I said, "what happened to..." I rattled off a list of names like Mossadegh of Iran, Arbenz of Guatemala, Allende of Chile, Lumumba of the Congo, Diem of Vietnam. "All of them," I said, "were overthrown, or..." I ran a finger across my throat. "Because they didn't play our game." I lay there in bed, once again in a cold sweat, realizing that this dream described my reality. I had done all that. It had been easy for me to provide government officials like the one in my dream with impressive materials that they could use to justify the loans to their people. My staff of economists, financial experts, statisticians, and mathematicians was skilled at developing sophisticated economic models that proved that such investments in electric power systems, highways, ports, airports, and industrial parks would spur economic growth. For years, I had also relied on those models to convince myself that my actions were beneficial. I had justified my job by the fact that gross domestic product did increase after the infrastructure was built. Now I came to face the facts of the story behind the mathematics. The statistics were highly biased. They were skewed to the fortunes of the families that owned the industries, banks, shopping malls, supermarkets, hotels, and a variety of other businesses that prospered from the infrastructure we built. They prospered. Everyone else suffered. Money that had been budgeted for health care, education, and other social services was diverted to pay interest on the loans. In the end, the principal was never paid down. The country was shackled by debt. Then International Monetary Fund, IMF, hitmen arrived and demanded that the government offer its oil or other resources to our corporations at cut-rate prices, and that the country privatize its electric, water, sewer, and other public sector institutions and sell them to the corporatocracy. Big business was the big winner. In every case, a key condition of such loans was that the projects would be built by our engineering and construction companies. Most of the money never left the United States. It simply was transferred from banking offices in Washington to engineering offices in New York, Houston, or San Francisco. We EHMs also made sure that the recipient country agreed to buy airplanes, medicine, tractors, computer technologies, and other goods and services from our corporations. Despite the fact that the money was returned almost immediately to the corporate members of the corporatocracy, the recipient country, the debtor, was required to pay it all back, principal plus interest. If an EHM was completely successful, the loans were so large that the debtor was forced to default on its payments after a few years. When this happened, we EHMs, like the mafia, demanded our pound of flesh. This often included one or more of the following: control over United Nations votes, the installation of military bases, or access to precious resources such as oil. Of course, the debtor still owed us the money, and another country was added to our global empire. Those nightmares helped me see that my life was not the life I wanted. I began to realize that, like the Andean brickmakers, I had to take responsibility for my life, for what I was doing to myself and to those people and their countries. But before I could grasp the deeper significance of this understanding that had begun to stir within me, I had to answer a crucial question. How did a nice kid from rural New Hampshire ever get into such a dirty business? Chapter 2. An Economic Hitman is Born. It began innocently enough. I was an only child, born into the middle class in 1945. Both my parents came from 3 centuries of New England Yankee stock. Their strict, moralistic, staunchly Republican attitudes reflected generations of puritanical ancestors. They were the first in their families to attend college, on scholarships. My mother became a high school Latin teacher. My father joined World War II as a Navy lieutenant and was in charge of the armed guard gun crew on a highly flammable merchant marine tanker in the Atlantic. When I was born, in Hanover, New Hampshire, he was recuperating from a broken hip in a Texas hospital. I did not see him until I was a year old. He took a job teaching languages at Tilton School, a boys' boarding school in rural New Hampshire. The campus stood high on a hill, proudly, some would say arrogantly, towering over the town of the same name. This exclusive institution limited its enrollment to about 50 students in each grade level, 9 through 12. The students were mostly the scions of wealthy families from Buenos Aires, Caracas, Boston, and New York. My family was cash-starved. However, we most certainly did not see ourselves as poor. Although the school's teachers received very little salary, all our needs were met at no charge. Food, housing, heat, water, and the workers who mowed our lawn and shoveled our snow. Beginning on my 4th birthday, I ate in the prep school dining room, shagged balls for the soccer teams my dad coached, and handed out towels in the locker room. It is an understatement to say that the teachers and their spouses felt superior to the locals. I used to hear my parents joking about being the lords of the manor, ruling over the lowly peasants, the townies. I knew it was more than a joke. My elementary and middle school friends belonged to that peasant class. They were very poor. Their parents were farmers, lumberjacks, and mill workers. They resented the preppies on the hill, and in turn, my father and mother discouraged me from socializing with the towny girls, whom my dad sometimes referred to as sluts. I had shared school books and crayons with these girls since 1st grade, and over the years, I fell in love with 3 of them, Anne, Priscilla, and Judy. I had a hard time understanding my parents' perspective. However, I deferred to their wishes. Every year we spent the 3 months of my dad's summer vacation at a lake cottage built by my grandfather in 1921. It was surrounded by forests, and at night we could hear owls and mountain lions. We had no neighbors. I was the only child within walking distance. In the early years, I passed the days by pretending that the trees were knights of the round table and damsels in distress named Anne, Priscilla, or Judy, depending on the year. My passion was, I had no doubt, as strong as that of Lancelot for Guinevere, and just as secretive. At 14, I received free tuition to Tilton School. With my parents prodding, I rejected everything to do with the town and never saw my old friends again. When my new classmates went home to their mansions and penthouses for vacation, I remained alone on the hill. Their girlfriends were debutantes. I had no girlfriends. All the girls I knew were sluts. I had cast them off, and they had forgotten me. I was alone, and terribly frustrated. My parents were masters at manipulation. They assured me that I was privileged to have such an opportunity, and that someday I would be grateful. I would find the perfect wife, one suited to our high moral standards. Inside, though, I seethed. I craved female companionship. The idea of sex was most alluring. However, rather than rebelling, I repressed my rage and expressed my frustration by excelling. I was an honors student, captain of 2 varsity teams, editor of the school newspaper. I was determined to show up my rich classmates and to leave Tilton behind forever. During my senior year, I was awarded a full scholarship to Brown. Although Ivy League schools did not officially grant athletic scholarships, this one came with a clear understanding that I would commit to playing soccer. I was also awarded a purely academic scholarship to Middlebury. I chose Brown mainly because I preferred being an athlete, and because it was located in a city. My mother had graduated from Middlebury, and my father had received his master's degree there, so even though Brown was in the Ivy League, they preferred Middlebury. "What if you break your leg?" my father asked. "Better to take the academic scholarship." I buckled. Middlebury was, in my perception, merely an inflated version of Tilton, albeit in rural Vermont instead of rural New Hampshire. True, it was co-ed, but I was poor in comparison to most everyone else in that school, and I had not attended school with a female in 4 years. I lacked confidence, felt outclassed, was miserable. I pleaded with my dad to let me drop out or take a year off. I wanted to move to Boston and learn about life and women. He would not hear of it. "How can I pretend to prepare other parents' kids for college if my own won't stay in one?" he asked. I have come to understand that life is composed of a series of coincidences. How we react to these, how we exercise what some refer to as free will, is everything. The choices we make within the boundaries of the twists of fate determine who we are. Two major coincidences that shaped my life occurred at Middlebury. One came in the form of an Iranian, the son of a general who was a personal advisor to the Shah. The other was a young woman named Anne, just like my childhood sweetheart. The first, whom I will call Farad, had played professional soccer in Rome. He was endowed with an athletic physique, curly black hair, soft walnut eyes, and a background and charisma that made him irresistible to women. He was my opposite, in many ways. I worked hard to win his friendship, and he taught me many things that would serve me well in the years to come. I also met Anne. Although she was seriously dating a young man who attended another college, she took me under her wing. Our platonic relationship was the first truly loving one I had ever experienced. Farad encouraged me to drink, party, and ignore my parents. I consciously chose to stop studying. I decided I would break my academic leg to get even with my father. My grades plummeted. I lost my scholarship. The college gave me a loan. It was my first introduction to debt. It felt dirty to me, this idea that I would be shackled to paying off the principal, plus interest, after I graduated. Halfway through my sophomore year, I elected to drop out. My father threatened to disown me. Farad egged me on. I stormed into the dean's office and quit school. It was a pivotal moment in my life. Farad and I celebrated my last night in town together at a local bar. A drunken farmer, a giant of a man, accused me of flirting with his wife, picked me up off my feet, and hurled me against a wall. Farad stepped between us, drew a knife, and slashed the farmer open at the cheek. Then he dragged me across the room and shoved me through a window, out onto a ledge high above Otter Creek. We jumped and made our way along the river and back to our dorm. The next morning, when interrogated by the campus police, I lied and refused to admit any knowledge of the incident. Nevertheless, Farad was expelled. We both moved to Boston and shared an apartment there. I landed a job at Hearst's Record American/Sunday Advertiser newspapers as a personal assistant to the editor-in-chief of the Sunday Advertiser. Later that year, 1965, several of my friends at the newspaper were drafted. To avoid a similar fate, I entered Boston University's College of Business Administration. By then, Anne had broken up with her old boyfriend, and she often traveled down from Middlebury to visit. I welcomed her attention. She was very funny and playful, and she helped soften the anger I felt over the Vietnam War. She had been an English major and inspired me to write short stories. She graduated in 1967, while I still had another year to complete at BU. She adamantly refused to move in with me until we were married, although I joked about being blackmailed, and in fact did resent what I saw as a continuation of my parents' archaic and prudish set of moral standards. I enjoyed our times together, and I wanted more. We married. Anne's father, a brilliant engineer, had masterminded the navigational system for an important class of missile and was rewarded with a high-level position in the Department of the Navy. His best friend, a man that Anne called Uncle Frank, not his real name, was employed as an executive at the highest echelons of the National Security Agency, NSA, the country's least known, and by most accounts, largest, spy organization. Shortly after our marriage, the military summoned me for my physical. I passed, and therefore faced the prospect of Vietnam upon graduation. The idea of fighting in Southeast Asia tore me apart emotionally, though war has always fascinated me. I was raised on tales about my colonial ancestors, who include Thomas Paine and Ethan Allen, and I'd visited all the New England and upstate New York battle sites of both the French and Indian and the Revolutionary Wars. I read every historical novel I could find. In fact, when Army Special Forces units first entered Southeast Asia, I was eager to sign up. But as the media exposed the atrocities and the inconsistencies of U.S. policy, I experienced a change of heart. I found myself wondering whose side Paine would have taken. I was sure he would have joined our Viet Cong enemies. Uncle Frank came to my rescue. He informed me that an NSA job made one eligible for draft deferment, and he arranged for a series of meetings at his agency, including a day of grueling polygraph-monitored interviews. I was told that these tests would determine whether I was suitable material for NSA recruitment and training, and if I was, they would provide a profile of my strengths and weaknesses, which would be used to map out my career. Given my attitude toward the Vietnam War, I was convinced I would fail the tests. Under examination, I admitted that, as a loyal American, I opposed the war, and I was surprised when the interviewers did not pursue this subject. Instead, they focused on my upbringing, my attitudes toward my parents, the emotions generated by the fact that I grew up feeling like a poor Puritan among so many wealthy, hedonistic preppies. They also explored my frustration about the lack of women, sex, and money in my life, and the fantasy world that had evolved as a result. I was amazed by the attention they gave to my relationship with Farad and their interest in my willingness to lie to the campus police to protect him. At first I assumed that all these things that seemed so negative to me marked me as an NSA reject, but the interviews continued, suggesting otherwise. It was not until several years later that I realized that, from an NSA viewpoint, these negatives actually were positive. Their assessments had less to do with the issues of loyalty to my country than with the frustrations of my life. Anger at my parents, an obsession with women, and my ambition to live the good life gave them a hook. I was seducible. My determination to excel in school and in sports, my ultimate rebellion against my father, my ability to get along with foreigners, and my willingness to lie to the police were exactly the types of attributes they sought. I also discovered, later, that Farad's father worked for the U.S. intelligence community in Iran. My friendship with Farad was therefore a definite plus. A few weeks after the NSA testing, I was offered a job to start training in the art of spying, to begin after I received my degree from BU several months later. However, before I had officially accepted this offer, I impulsively attended a seminar given at BU by a Peace Corps recruiter. A major selling point was that, like the NSA's, Peace Corps jobs made one eligible for draft deferments. The decision to sit in on that seminar was one of those coincidences that seemed insignificant at the time, but turned out to have life-changing implications. The recruiter described several places in the world that especially needed volunteers. One of these was the Amazon rainforest, where, he pointed out, indigenous people lived very much as natives of North America had until the arrival of Europeans. I had always dreamed of living like the Abenaki, who inhabited New Hampshire when my ancestors first settled there. I knew I had Abenaki blood in my veins, and I wanted to learn the type of forest lore they understood so well. I approached the recruiter after his talk and asked about the possibility of being assigned to the Amazon. He assured me there was a great need for volunteers in that region, and that my chances would be excellent. I called Uncle Frank. To my surprise, Uncle Frank encouraged me to consider the Peace Corps. He confided that after the fall of Hanoi, which in those days was deemed a certainty by men in his position, the Amazon would become a hot spot. "Loaded with oil," he said. "We'll need good agents there, people who understand the natives." He assured me that the Peace Corps would be an excellent training ground, and he urged me to become proficient in Spanish as well as in local indigenous dialects. "You might," he chuckled, "end up working for a private company instead of the government." I did not understand what he meant by that at the time. I was being upgraded from spy to EHM, although I had never heard the term and would not for a few more years. I had no idea that there were hundreds of men and women scattered around the world, working for consulting firms and other private companies, people who never received a penny of salary from any government agency, and yet were serving the interests of empire. Nor could I have guessed that a new type with more euphemistic titles would number in the thousands by the end of the millennium, and that I would play a significant role in shaping this growing army. Anne and I applied to the Peace Corps and requested an assignment in the Amazon. When our acceptance notification arrived, my first reaction was one of extreme disappointment. The letter stated that we would be sent to Ecuador. "Oh no," I thought. "I requested the Amazon, not Africa." I went to an atlas and looked up Ecuador. I was dismayed when I could not find it anywhere on the African continent. In the index, though, I discovered that it is indeed located in Latin America, and I saw on the map that the river systems flowing off its Andean glaciers form the headwaters to the mighty Amazon. Further reading assured me that Ecuador's jungles were some of the world's most diverse and formidable, and that the indigenous people still lived much as they had for millennia. We accepted. Anne and I completed Peace Corps training in Southern California and headed for Ecuador in September 1968. We lived in the Amazon in the territory of the Shuar, whose lifestyle did indeed resemble that of pre-colonial North Americans. Then we moved to the Andes, where I worked with the brickmakers, descendants of the Incans. It was a side of the world I never dreamed still existed. Until then, the only Latin Americans I had met were the wealthy preppies at the school where my father taught. I found myself sympathizing with these indigenous people who subsisted on hunting, farming, and molding bricks from local clay, and baking them in primitive ovens. I felt an odd sort of kinship with them. Somehow, they reminded me of the townies I had left behind. One day a man in a business suit, Einar Grave, landed at the airstrip in our community. He was the vice president of Chaz T. Maine Incorporated, Maine, an international consulting firm that kept a very low profile, and was in charge of studies to determine whether the World Bank should lend Ecuador and its neighboring countries billions of dollars to build hydroelectric dams and other infrastructure projects. Einar also was a colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve. He started talking with me about the benefits of working for a company like Maine. When I mentioned that I had been accepted by the NSA before joining the Peace Corps and that I was considering going back to them, he informed me that he sometimes acted as an NSA liaison. He gave me a look that made me suspect that part of his assignment was to evaluate my capabilities. I now believed that he was updating my profile, and especially sizing up my abilities to survive in environments most North Americans would find hostile. We spent a couple of days together in Ecuador, and afterward communicated by mail. He asked me to send him reports assessing Ecuador's economic prospects. I had a small portable typewriter, loved to write, and was quite happy to comply with this request. Over a period of about a year, I sent Einar at least 15 long letters. In these letters, I speculated on Ecuador's economic and political future, and appraised the growing frustration among the indigenous communities as they struggled to confront oil companies, international development agencies, and other attempts to draw them into the modern world. When my Peace Corps tour was over, Einar invited me to a job interview at Maine headquarters in Boston. During our private meeting, he emphasized that Maine's primary business was engineering, but that his biggest client, the World Bank, recently had begun insisting that he keep economists on staff to produce the critical economic forecasts used to determine the feasibility and magnitude of engineering projects. He confided that he had previously hired three highly qualified economists with impeccable credentials, two with master's degrees and one with a PhD. They had failed miserably. None of them, Einar said, can handle the idea of producing economic forecasts in countries where reliable statistics aren't available. He went on to tell me that, in addition, all of them had found it impossible to fulfill the terms of their contracts, which required them to travel to remote places in countries such as Ecuador, Indonesia, Iran, and Egypt, to interview local leaders, and to provide personal assessments about the prospects for economic development in those regions. One had suffered a nervous breakdown in an isolated Panamanian village. He was escorted by Panamanian police to the airport and put on a plane back to the United States. The letters you sent me indicate that you don't mind sticking your neck out, even when hard data isn't available. And given your living conditions in Ecuador, I'm confident you can survive almost anywhere. He told me that he had already fired one of those economists and was prepared to do the same with the other two, if I accepted the job. So it was that in January 1971, I was offered a position as an economist with Maine. I had turned 26, the magical age when the draft board no longer wanted me. I consulted with Anne's family. They encouraged me to take the job, and I assumed this reflected Uncle Frank's attitude as well. I recalled him mentioning the possibility that I would end up working for a private firm. Nothing was ever stated openly, but I had no doubt that my employment at Maine was a consequence of the arrangements Uncle Frank had made 3 years earlier, in addition to my experiences in Ecuador and my willingness to write about that country's economic and political situation. My head reeled for several weeks, and I had a very swollen ego. I had earned only a bachelor's degree from BU, which did not seem to warrant a position as an economist with such a lofty consulting company. I knew that many of my BU classmates who had been rejected by the draft and had gone on to earn MBAs and other graduate degrees would be overcome with jealousy. I visualized myself as a dashing secret agent, heading off to exotic lands, lounging beside hotel swimming pools, surrounded by gorgeous bikini-clad women, martini in hand. Although this was merely fantasy, I would discover that it held elements of truth. Einar had hired me as an economist, but I was soon to learn that my real job went far beyond that, and that it was in fact closer to James Bond's than I ever could have guessed. Chapter 3. In for Life. In legal parlance, Maine would be called a closely held corporation. Roughly 5% of its 2,000 employees owned the company. These were referred to as partners or associates, and their position was coveted. Not only did the partners have power over everyone else, but they also made the big bucks. Discretion was their hallmark. They dealt with heads of state and other chief executive officers who expected their consultants, like their attorneys and psychotherapists, to honor a strict code of absolute confidentiality. Talking with the press was taboo. It simply was not tolerated. As a consequence, hardly anyone outside Maine had ever heard of us, although many were familiar with our competitors, such as Arthur D. Little, Stone & Webster, Brown & Root, Halliburton, and Bechtel. I use the term competitors loosely because, in fact, Maine was in a league by itself. The majority of our professional staff was engineers, yet we owned no equipment and never constructed so much as a storage shed. Many Mainers were ex-military. However, we did not contract with the Department of Defense or with any of the military services. Our stock in trade was something so different from the norm that during my first months there, even I could not figure out what we did. I knew only that my first real assignment would be in Indonesia, and that I would be part of an 11-man team sent to create a master energy plan for the island of Java. I also knew that Einar and others who discussed the job with me were eager to convince me that Java's economy would boom, and that if I wanted to distinguish myself as a good forecaster, and to therefore be offered promotions, I would produce projections that demonstrated as much. Right off the chart, Einar liked to say. He would glide his fingers through the air and up over his head. An economy that will soar like a bird. Einar took frequent trips that usually lasted only 2 to 3 days. No one talked much about them or seemed to know where he had gone. When he was in the office, he often invited me to sit with him for a few minutes over coffee. He asked about Anne, our new apartment, and the cat we had brought with us from Ecuador. I grew bolder as I came to know him better, and I tried to learn more about him and what I would be expected to do in my job. But I never received answers that satisfied me. He was a master at turning conversations around. On one such